Okay, this is us, I guess. We're up to chapter 9, the roots of willfulness. Something we can all relate to. And if we can't, then we're blinded by these problems that we're going to look at. And we could think about willfulness as a kind of a character defect without even thinking about the fact that our understanding of things here as we find them in the Fathers, as when we prepare for Great Lent, we talk about trying to have the soul lead the body instead of having the body lead the soul. Deepanek in this chapter points out that if we have this passion of self-love, love of one's physical self, not that the physical person is in any way bad, but it's not the ultimate to love ourselves more than God, more than others. And if that's our condition, then our appetites that have to do with the body will feed desires into the desiring part of the soul, and then we'll act on those desires that actually come from our love of the body. And when we use the thinking part of the soul, the highest part of the soul, we'll use it to justify the desires that we have. So it's possible to even have an idea of willfulness that we could be critical of while remaining in that condition. And if that's what we're doing, then we're not talking about what Deepanek was talking about at all in terms of willfulness. So maybe this helps. When I was in Miami for the Diocesan Assembly, I found this nice, different copy of the Philokalia, translated from the original Greek and edited by Constantine Cavernos. They have a number of writings by Constantine Cavernos there at Miami. They had him there years ago and are very fond of him. I was fortunate enough to have been there when he was there, and I bought a number of those shorter writings. But this time, I bought this copy of the Philokalia that he had translated. It's a two-volume set, this Philokalia, and it is just really, really readable. It's unbelievable. Deepanek has mentioned that the four-volume set is so scholarly that it is difficult to read, and mentioned other alternatives, but this one, it reads like any other book. It's unbelievable, and I've been reading it, and there is something here that's related to the chapter that we're looking at tonight. This is from the writings of St. Anthony the Great, from his councils at any rate, whether he himself wrote them or whether someone wrote them down for him. And he says this is one of his counsels on the character of men and on the virtuous life in 170 texts. And the third one reads like this: we have received from God self-restraint, forbearance, temperance, perseverance, patience, and the like, which are great and virtuous powers that oppose and resist difficulties and help us to face them. And the thing that I want to point out is that if our desires are of a worldly nature, we still have the ability to use self-restraint, forbearance, temperance, perseverance, patience, and all of these powers in the service of accomplishing goals that may be entirely worldly, that may take their inspiration from our love of material things, our love of the world. But it's possible, and this is when we're talking about spiritual life, we are never talking about that, because we're never talking about using these virtuous powers in the service of a world-oriented and a world-loving life. We're always talking about using those powers in the service of a desire for God and a desire to be able to love others more fully and to be able to see within ourselves, see the sinfulness in ourselves. And then those same virtues have a different orientation. Now, I remember the first time I figured this out, not in this kind of detail, and I had to come up with my own ways of thinking about it myself. And the point, as I first understood it, not clearly like this, was that depending on our spiritual orientation, the same things that we might do could be either spiritually positive or spiritually negative. And we might be exercising virtues very effectively and efficiently. But if we're oriented toward goals that are worldly, then we're at the mercy of passions. But if we use these powers, these virtuous powers, with an orientation toward God, we become less worldly and move closer toward God. This is a critical thing, it seems to me. And I think that's related to some of the things that we'll talk about in this chapter. And if it is, I'm sure it will turn up again. This is a pretty straightforward chapter. There are only one page of questions, only five questions for us to consider. So I don't think we need to labor that hard on it as far as understanding the material. But as brief a chapter as it is, and as straightforward a chapter as it is, these are very difficult things to deal with. And the problem, the thing that makes them so difficult, is the fact that if our orientation is, and it is for virtually all of us, we have to intentionally try to be conscious of this orientation toward the world rather than God, and question ourselves and evaluate ourselves. And then once we understand what our spiritual condition is, then engage in prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, deliver me from self-importance and thinking I know best, and give me self-knowledge. She says at the end of the chapter, you can't think your way out of a conviction of self-importance. You can't meditate your way out of it. You can only pray to be delivered from it. So if we're in this kind of condition, there is going to be an awful lot that we are blind of. We are going to be convinced, even if someone were to point out this spiritual disorientation for us, and point out to us what our real assumptions are about the things of ultimate value, we will not be able to see it if we are in bondage to this condition. The first few things she says in the chapter really set things up. She says, knowing the roots of willfulness will enable us to get a cure for much of our chronic depression. Depression, the problem of many of us, most of us, in our society today. That's because the saints say the main cause of depression is willfulness. We willfully desire something, and everything depends on whether or not we're able to get whatever it is that we desire. The root causes of willfulness, then, which is in turn the most common underlying cause of depression, are the things that we need to look at. Being so set on what we want that we don't care to hear about what God wants for us. It's just not a factor. In fact, if God comes into it and we're in this condition, we will pray that he give us whatever it is that we desire. And since we're in this condition of spiritual disorientation, he's not going to add to that. And then we can suffer the loss of hope. How willful we are is very important, because it is the single thing that she says will mainly determine whether we're going to be content or be unhappy in life. So willfulness is a real matter of practical concern. The first question reads like this. The desiring part of the soul, the will, now that's the central part of the soul, you know, the thinking part, the desiring part, and the active part. What is another term that she uses for that part of the soul? I'm a little tired, so I might not be that sharp. You might need to help me out. Is it the appetitive part of the soul?
Excitable part.
The part that is self-acting, that acts on its own. Once it has its desires, it takes off. So the desiring part of the soul, which can desire either the things of the world or spiritual things, normally aims at whatever goal the thinking power of the soul assigns to it. But remember, if we are upside down and we're getting our desires from a love of carnal things, and of course carnal is not simply a reference to sexuality, carnal, a carne, it's a reference to any physical things, fleshly things, materialistic desires. Ordinarily, the thinking part of the soul assigns desires to the will. But if the mind is not controlling it, the passion of self-love arises in the excitable part of the soul, so from the bottom up, and takes control of the will, giving it carnal desires. Once that happens, then we will automatically pursue materialistic things and forget about God. And if we think about it, we will just think about it in terms of, you know, how come you're not helping me, God, to get these material things that I want and need? This self-love is passionate and irrational love of one's physical self and its appetites. And she asks us, what are some of the desires and material cravings that self-love will produce in a person? And Steve's got his book back.
Russell did.
Okay. Out-Russell'd him.
Out-Russell'd
him. Desires and material cravings. On page 157, the passion of self-love produces desires for such things as money, possessions, physical thrills, drugs, anything satisfying, relaxing, stimulating, or exciting to the flesh and fleshly imagination. Television, movies, entertainment, entertaining books, all those things that we use to distract ourselves from spiritual life, all of those things are examples of desires and material cravings self-love will produce in us. She asks us to discuss the statement by Hilary of Poitiers on page 159. I'm probably mispronouncing that. I know, what's his name? There's an actor by the name of Poitiers, and I don't know if he spells his name that way or not. And I never know for sure if I'm pronouncing St. Hilary's name right. Do you ever push truth aside because you'd rather not see it? You know, the question is, what do we got to do sometimes in order to become aware of whether or not we're doing that? We really have to take some stock of ourselves. But here is St. Hilary's statement. Opinions once formed cling with excessive obstinacy to the point that we will maintain that they are not opinions, that these are things that we know. You know, because what is the thinking part of the soul doing? Justifying any of those things, not questioning them. When the will is not subject to the reason of the thinking power, this spiritual intellect, remember. How does that thinking power get to be not spiritual, but just functionally rational, focused on the things of the world? It's exactly by being reduced to the capacity to think rationally. The spiritual aspect of our thinking is lost if our desires are captured by a desire for the satisfaction of our self-love. Inquiry after truth gives way to the search for proofs of what we wish to believe. There's a lot of that. It passes for reason. The search for proofs of what we wish to believe. We don't even question what we wish to believe. Desire is paramount over truth, once we're in this condition. If desire had not overcome reason, then instead of trying to set up our desires as doctrine, we should let our doctrines dictate our desires. In other words, our understanding of how we ought to be. In this case, doctrines is not the doctrine of the Trinity necessarily, but it is our doctrine about what we are supposed to be like spiritually, what our soul is supposed to be like, what the orientation and movement of the soul is supposed to be like, how the powers of the soul are meant to be used. That's our doctrine when it comes to spiritual life. And that doctrine ought to be passed to our desires so that we can reason spiritually in order to make our life in the world into a process of becoming more rather than less spiritual. There would be no contradiction of truth, for everyone would begin by desiring what is true if we were in this good condition, instead of defending the truth of what we desired. Not unmindful of this sin of willfulness, the apostle writing to Timothy says, "For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine. Having itching ears, will heap up teachers to themselves after their own lusts, will have a real desire to find someone who will help us to justify and rationalize our desires." And there are lots of people who make a good living by helping people do that. They're even considered spiritual guides. And once people are in this condition, they will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside unto fables. I just redid my quizzes for Ayn Rand today, so fables are right in the front of my mind. Fables like those in the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. As you know, the interesting thing about Ayn Rand is she grew up in Russia, the Russia before the revolution and during the revolution and immediately after the revolution. She grew up in a Russia where the way of understanding the world that was the norm was that of Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And of course, the communists had taken over and they were working hard to put an end to that. But that's the way Russians understood the world, according to the teachings of the church. And Ayn Rand's philosophy takes an Eastern Orthodox way of understanding the world and turns it upside down. And most Americans don't realize that. There have been some very good research and some scholarly work that has been done on that, and it is part of the foundation of the section of that course that I just finished writing quiz questions for. It comes at the end of the course, so it's really at the front of my mind. And it gives me an opportunity, which is irony of ironies, not just to criticize Rand, but also to present Orthodox Christian ethics and morality. That ethics and morality and that understanding of life that she turned upside down. Because who is John Galt? I can tell you, he is the secular icon of Jesus Christ. He is the secularized icon of Jesus Christ. That's who John Galt is. It's interesting. Fables. And so she writes, she's very much upfront about the idea that she's not writing a realistic novel when she writes things like The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. She calls her philosophy romantic realism, a realistic portrayal of an atheistic idealism that takes the person and puts them in the place of Christ, because of course she hates Christianity. But the particular vision of Christ, the Christ whose place she takes, is an Eastern Orthodox understanding of who Christ is. It's really, really interesting. There are a whole slew of Eastern Orthodox Christian assumptions that she shares. She secularizes all of them. It's really interesting. So, well, anyway, fables, fables. You too can be Jesus Christ for yourself. Fables. And she's one of those teachers that justify setting up our own desires as absolute. The whole thrust of true Christianity, Eastern Orthodox Christianity, the full teaching of the Christian faith, has to do with our oneness with others, our oneness with God. We can't be one with others unless we are at one with God. And of course, for her part, and someone in this condition is functionally like this at a psychological level, others mean nothing. Others mean nothing to the atheist who takes themselves as their own God. Well, whether or not we go to the trouble of justifying ourselves by coming up with something like Ayn Rand's philosophy, whether we do it or whether we don't, psychologically, we are the way she describes people romantically in her philosophy. That's why it appeals to us, because it appeals to our selfishness, which she says is a virtue. It appeals to our experience of what it is like to have a desire and an ideal of our own and separation from all others, and be in conflict with others and constantly be feeling like, as Deepanak says in her book, that we are not getting the honor that we deserve. Pride is a virtue for her. So it's exactly the opposite of the direction spiritually that we're trying to move in here. So that's an example. That's my example of one of the teachers for our lusts that has come along, a very popular one, that has come up with a doctrine that suits our desires. And they do. Hers do. She tells us what our psychological egoism, what our desires want to hear. And that's her proof. You know this is the way it really is, she will say. And it makes us blind to any kind of spiritual recognition of what I like to call the spiritual reality of things, which has nothing to do with this fantasy of being able to live as though we were the only human being on the face of the earth. And then, of course, you know, everyone else gets the opportunity to do the same thing. We can all live as though we were all the only human being on the face of the earth. And if you're a Randian, then what do? And you're all isolated from each other, and each one of you is living as an isolated individual unit who has your values and nobody shares them. That's what she says. How do you interact with others? Well, you exchange. I have something that I think is important. I will give it to you. You have something that I think is important. I will give it to you. We'll exchange it. So her model is the economic enterprise of capitalism. Nothing against capitalism. The point is, this has nothing to do with capitalism. What this has to do with is pretending that we are all isolated from one another. Each one of us is an absolute individual that has our values, that are my values, are not your values. You have the freedom to have your values, but we can exchange things that are of value with one another. And that's our relationship. And she calls that love, incidentally. You know, so there is a way to try to rationalize this in your mind. Deepanak's question, do you ever push truth aside because you'd rather not see it? And I'm wondering, to what degree are we aware of pushing truth aside because we'd rather not see it? This happens to me very fleetingly, usually. So if you don't affirm it and reorient yourself in the opposite direction, it disappears so quickly that you don't even have a memory of it. Now, have other people had similar experiences? Or want to discuss anything, you know, in what Hillary, you know, St. Hillary says.
I think sometimes when I hear the truth and I don't want to hear the truth, I really am totally angry. And so when I go back and process, you know, I guess there's a choice there for me that I can go back and process. And go back through and say, well, what, you know, check, well, why was I angry about that? And then sometimes it comes down to, well, even sometimes this truth isn't spoken nicely, but truth is truth and it doesn't change. And so,
right, sometimes, yeah. And there's the prayer for enemies, where it's pointed out to us that so often that the enemies are people who don't mind telling us the truth because they don't care. So sometimes we can hear the truth out of the mouths of people who don't care, you know, what they say. So it might not be pleasant, and we get angry. And you're saying that we're not just angry because they were nasty. We're angry because there's a grain of truth in what they said, which makes it even worse. You know.
Well, and it takes effort for me to go back and cross them, to go back and
separate that.
Separate, so, you know, really dig into why I was angry, and really, that's usually when I find it, is that there was a truth there that just rubbed me wrong or whatever. But there's always the choice to go back and process and spend the energy to do that, or just you know, sweep it under the rug.
Yeah.
Or blame that person, you know, the harsh or the whatever, the way I didn't like the way they said something. You know, it can be about that person or just.
Which is irrelevant. Irrelevant to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But if we're willful, we can just zoom right past it.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure I did. I'm sure I missed it a lot.
Oh, me too.
Uh-huh.
You know, but reflection does help. And it makes you, I mean, you oftentimes can go back and revisit things. But it makes you wonder how many times, you know, and I'm thinking of myself, how many times do I just miss things altogether? And I can't go back and reevaluate it because, you know, I didn't even experience it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
To know that there was more involved than just, oh, somebody was nasty.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then we come to confession, and what do we confess? I reacted badly because somebody was nasty to me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, you know, that's something. But how about the part we may have missed? You know, the truth in what they said that made us angry. Because then we're satisfied. I mean, we confessed. We got angry. You shouldn't have gotten angry. Yeah. Why? Sometimes what you're saying, why did we get angry? We can uncover a lot that way. If we think we had the right to be angry. And that's the time that's most difficult to confess, when we feel justified. Because then the thinking part of the soul, it's got its work done for it.
You don't want to accept them as readily because you're just like, well, that doesn't really fit in with, you know, how I see things. And instead of changing your mindset about things and realizing this is truth, you can accept it or you can reject it, you know, you have to change your mindset in order to, you know, actually accept those things. Because it's a practice in saying, well, even if I don't understand it, it doesn't match what I want to believe, you still accept it because it's truth.
That's a really interesting sort of a thing to me. And I haven't found a good enough way to talk about it, or even to myself, to explain it to myself, how important it is for us to acknowledge the truth of teachings that are just not comfortable. Without, and as you're saying, it would require a complete change of mind, a complete change of heart, to be comfortable with it. We might say it that way. But that's not so easy, and we all know that that's not easy, and it's part of the tradition to know that it's not easy, and it's part of the tradition to acknowledge the fact that it takes anyone years and years, in lots of cases, for that kind of change to take place, and desiring it and praying for it all the time. And so one of the things that I think is really important, and this is the part that is so difficult for me to find a way to put into words, we have to get used to the idea that we are going to be uncomfortable a lot. Recognize the truth and not feel like, because once we recognize the truth, what we are going to want to do is to find some way to deal with it once and for all. Okay, I see that that's the truth. What have I got to do? Maybe I need to go to a monastery and totally change myself so that I can be the way I'm supposed to be. No, and that's not the answer. The answer is to recognize that we are distant from what we believe is how we ought to be, and not forget about it, not accept that it, you know, well, it's okay, or in some way, find some way to make it comfortable. It's just for monks or something like that. No, it's not just for monks. Monks are making a serious, the most serious kind of effort to make that change that we can see is necessary, but what are we going to do? I mean, we could just say, well, no, I don't believe that. Then we would get back to a nice, comfortable kind of condition. But it's important for us in so many cases in our lives as Orthodox Christians in America for us to recognize that there is no way to resolve these things by using our minds to come up with a way that makes them comfortable and convenient. They are uncomfortable, they are inconvenient, and they are the truth. And we can't forget about them. And so we worship God in humility. There is no way to resolve these difficulties when we come across them. And we come across them, I think, pretty regularly, because our faith is a faith that is constantly making an effort to push these things in the front of our attention. All the things that we sing in the hymnography and all of the prayers that we have, they are constantly making an effort to have us see the truth and acknowledge it as the truth, whether or not we can successfully do something about it or not. And I've tried different ways to come up with a way of talking about this, that maybe there's something that's not so bad about hypocrisy, because we need to recognize that even though I'm not like that, and even though I look and see in myself not much of an effort to move in that direction, I refuse to reject the fact that these things are the truth. That's a spiritual condition in which we find ourselves a lot. And even remaining there is an effort, because we want to make it comfortable. We want to find some way, you know, to make it comfortable. And we shouldn't. You know, it's part of it. Maybe if we live with it long enough and are sufficiently uncomfortable with it, we will have the desire to move in the direction that we should move. I mean, if we move just a little tiny bit, so long as we never resolve that tension, that stretching that goes on inside of us. So these are things that really fascinate me, because they are about the truth. You know, I mean, the truth is not generally some kind of absolute statement of doctrine. Sure, there are truths. There are dogmatic truths like that. But we're talking about recognizing the spiritual truth of who we are in relationship to God and what kind of condition we're in. That's critical. I mean, we lose the ability to do that, nothing's going to happen. And then we'll be real hypocrites.
Something that's probably more damaging than even how aware you are of the truth is just being apathetic towards it. You might know exactly what the truth is. I was just thinking about, like, some people that I know are just a-religious. I mean, they don't even care to make a stance. It's like, oh, okay, I'm going to say, well, I believe this. They even want to make a stance on what they believe. This was one of my professors and I were talking about the current culture now, where it was being called the post-postmodern
culture. Oh, really? So what does that mean, we're modern?
I kind of descended a little bit from it and said that I think that our culture is becoming more apathetic. Like, they don't even really care to even give themselves a name. It's just, you know what, I'm tired of arguing this, I'm tired of hearing these arguments. I'm done. And you can sit back and argue all you want, but they're just going to walk away because they don't even care to even hear the debate anymore. I was trying to think if that might even kind of tie in with a little bit of Ayn Rand, and they're just completely flipping everything up, the orthodoxy upside down.
Of course, that's not how she would look at it. I
mean. Of course not.
She actually had a teacher who taught later at St. Vladimir Seminary, Anna Olosky, briefly. She was a philosophy student in St. Petersburg. She didn't take a degree. but she had some instruction. And I can imagine a student just kind of rejecting everything that the professor says. I mean, what, don't we do that as students sometimes? Just whatever they come up with, I'm against it, and I look at complete in the upside down, completely opposite way. And I have a real suspicion that far from a really deep analysis of the things that she was dealing with, she just kind of egotistically, you know, not egoistically, but egotistically, you know, engaged in that in big time. You know, I think a lot of the roots of what she thinks has to do with that student experience. But you were saying about applying this to some kind of something that might have something to do with Rand, upside down, something else.
It was being completely flipping around your thoughts, understanding
right.
of being selfless and
selfish.
Yeah. Selfish,
sure.
To the point.
It was reactionary.
Yes.
You know, question, no question. It's reactionary. Yeah.
I have a whole line of thoughts. I'm just going to stop.
Sorry.
Right there. No.
Well,
no.
You pick one out and you know.
Oh, I don't want to follow myself down that rabbit hole.
Okay. Anything else on that? Is Saint Hilary of Poitiers. I'm going to say it like that.
You're talking about fleeing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when growing up Protestant, it was almost like you weren't really. You were encouraged not to dwell on sins.
How do you
at
mean?
All. Like, just almost to, you know, if you realize you've sinned, just forget about it and live. You know, just kind of forget about it because Christ has already forgiven you and it's done. You're already saved and going to heaven.
Because you can't do anything about it anyway?
Yeah. And just kind of.
There's something I don't understand here.
Yeah.
And maybe somebody can explain it to me. I mean, the clearest example of it that I can think of is in the course. I had to do something for Thanksgiving week. Students have, you know, it's an online course. So I generally, in the past, I've just ignored Thanksgiving week. It's just a week like any other week. It's an online course. Get over it. But I didn't do that this year. I have a recognition of Thanksgiving on that week. And I put up a video of the history of Thanksgiving and gave a little mini quiz on that. So I watched this History Channel, nice video on Thanksgiving. And they talked about 1621, what we call generally the first Thanksgiving. And what they had there was no turkey, incidentally. They didn't have turkey. They had lobster, though, which is interesting, because that would be fasting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So I put this little graphic of a cartoon turkey holding up a big sign saying eat lobster, you know. That's my graphic for the week. But in the history of Thanksgiving, they mention all of the things that, you know, about how the Indians helped the Puritans by teaching them how to hunt and how to fish and how to do all these things they couldn't have gotten through the winter without. But in the video, it mentioned the next few generations, the descendants of the Puritans. When they celebrated Thanksgiving at that time of year, how did they celebrate it? They celebrated it by prayer and fasting and giving thanks to God in special services. They didn't celebrate it by feasting. That is the traditional New England Puritan way to celebrate Thanksgiving. And I thought, gee, if that were the American tradition, we'd have no problem. We just fast like the colonial pilgrims did after that first Thanksgiving when they were being thankful to God and to their friends, the Indians, and sharing this food with them. But the idea that it's supposed to be this big self-indulgent blowout, that's not the traditional. It turns out that's not the traditional American Thanksgiving until you get way down into American history later on. And I thought that was interesting. And so the question is, getting back to the, you know, the question at hand is, if I'm a Calvinist, or even most, all Western Christians really, and I believe that because of the fall, we don't have the capacity to be good, right? You know, now I know God enables us to be good by acting on us from outside. There is grace that enables us to be good. And we could, I guess, turn away from that grace unless you teach that you can't. You know, God decides somebody's going to be good and that's it. They're good. Well, it doesn't have anything to do with them. because it's special grace. But if all of that is the case, and synergy, cooperation with God, is impossible, as Luther specifically mentions that it is, why is so much effort put into following moral rules? And people are punished. I mean, if you break one of those moral rules, you're put in the stocks, or you're excluded from the community or something like that. So there's a lot of punishment for not being good. Now, how can you punish people for not being good if whether or not they are good depends on God's grace? How does that work? Because I don't understand that. I don't understand that. And it is important. People are expected to be good. How does that work without synergy? How does it work? And I just don't know. So we have a lot of former Protestants here. And I mean, I know I was one, but I'm a special case because I was totally secularized by the time I was 17. So I don't understand that. And it is important. So, and it also means that it's unfair for us as Orthodox to say bad things about Protestants and justify it by saying they don't believe it is possible that we have the capacity to be good, because it can't be true. We must be saying something that's not true, because they put a lot of effort into being good. I know, you know, you would give the glory to God if you're good. That would be humble. I can understand that part. But there is something there I don't get about Protestant piety.
I think there's just not the connection. I mean, you're a person, you can be good or bad, make a choice. It's all your choice.
It is.
It's just a part from synergy with God. It's a very individualistic. I don't understand it either.
Aren't we totally corrupt? Aren't we corrupt? Or does corruption doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you can do a good thing?
We're corrupt, except that if we have Jesus in our heart, he's matching.
He's doing it.
He's matching. I'm just telling you that thing.
I'm just trying to figure it out.
This is the thoughts I have. I don't know about anybody else growing up. He's magic, and we ask him to forgive us.
And you know, there
it's
is
like a. We have power in ourselves or something. I mean, the synergy with God is not. It's
no.
Just not taught.
Cooperation with God.
Right.
No.
It's
well,
just
yeah.
Not taught.
When
so,
it comes up, they say, no, that's not possible. You
so
need to be saved.
We're all little gods.
We're what?
We're all little gods.
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't.
I
that doesn't sound
I think
right.
One of the reasons we're all here today is because we don't understand the question.
Oh, well, if you guys got that, you wouldn't be here. Okay.
Right.
Well, that makes sense. Okay, well, I'll just keep looking. I'll let you know if I figure something out. Question number 3, do you feel that you know best without having to check the facts with credible authorities? Well, it's a great burden. Always being right. Which I've tried to explain to Sharon, but so far I'm not getting a lot of sympathy, you know. You know, I love the feeling of knowing best, sure.
It's usually just a feeling, not reality.
Of knowing best. It's usually what?
So it's usually just a feeling, not reality, though.
Yeah. Well, the feeling is sufficient,
yes.
Right?
The feeling's good. You don't have to actually be right.
So then you think about feelings. Yeah, they don't have to be connected to reality. I mean, you don't have to look beyond them. Why upset the boat? Are you comfortable saying about a question, I don't know? I am, but I don't do it often because I usually feel like I know. So I'm answering that honestly. And then when I, in fact, I take such pleasure out of saying I don't know, you know, that I think I'm getting something out of it. You know, I'm being, and it's not humility. I can tell that. So.
A credible authorities part is pretty important.
Well,
you have to feel like you know best without having to check the record. Because I'm the kind of person that always likes to ask everybody their opinions. I want to know.
Well, you know, I'm talking credible authorities not here, right. Man and not man on the street,
right.
You know.
Right, well, you know, so I trust a lot of people who I think are good people, you know. They're not necessarily my priest or my, you know, whatever, but
well,
I
are they, but are they credible authorities?
But that's the one thing I got to start making sure I talk to. If I'm going to ask somebody their opinion to really help me think about something in life, I ought to really make sure they're, is this really somebody that I would want to consider a credible authority?
On this particular, on whatever particular topic it is.
Right.
I mean, is it Roger Clemens who's going to start pitching for an independent league?
Yeah, for right? League.
Yeah, which is, I think it's so cool.
He's 50 now.
Yeah, he's gonna murder those people. I'm sure, you know. But you know, you might ask him about what you're doing wrong with your pitch.
Oh yeah.
But you wouldn't want to go to him for anything else. What kind of razor blades do you use? You know? How about aftershave, you know?
Right.
How about a little spiritual advice, you know? Especially in his case, having just squeaked by.
Just squeaked by.
Out of Washington. So credible authorities in our case would be fathers, those who know because by experience, you know, and by an experience that isn't individualistic, but is the same as the experience of all the other fathers who are credible on this particular thing, whatever it is that you're trying to find out about.
I think that, I would say, getting back to, are you comfortable saying, I don't know? I think all right for a little while, like to be kind of comfortable with, I don't know.
Yeah, but some people are too comfortable with I don't know.
Then there comes a certain point where you just kind of, you get cornered and it's like, okay, I've got to know the answer to this question.
Yeah, sometimes you do.
Yeah. A lot of it's just inconsequential things, at least
yeah,
for me.
That's true.
I think, you know, he was saying he has to work on the credible story. I think that I don't know things is the area that I need to work on. And a lot of times, I'm very comfortable saying I don't know. And it's because I don't want to put the work into trying to understand the whole thing. And so it's more a laziness and selfish thing of like, oh, I don't know. Because I don't want to have to go through the effort and the trial of like trying to really dissect and figure out. You know, there's some things that I definitely have to know about. But when it comes to spiritual matters, a lot of times I'm like, oh, well, I don't know. Ask Quentin, you know.
Okay. You often ask God what to think about something. How do we go about doing that?
Wait, what's this like? What are you asking now?
Same question. Oh, are you comfortable about saying a question I don't know? Do you often ask God what to think about something? Because the idea is that we can function quite well without checking credible authorities and not saying I don't know very often and certainly not necessarily asking God what to think about something. But what I'm asking is, how do we go about doing that? I know how I go about doing it generally.
I ask everybody. That's why I got to make sure I start asking.
You don't leave God. Don't leave God out.
I don't leave God out. I don't think.
As maybe, far as asking Him,
I probably do it at times.
I do it by reading people, credible authorities. If you read a credible authority, like if I read Saint Isaac of Syria. I expect him to be saying things that are going to be beyond the way I ordinarily understand things, and yet they will make sense to me as far as what's written there. And I'm not going to understand them unless I am humble and want God to help me understand. So when I go to the fathers, I don't go to them the way you would go to a secular expert. I go to them in order to initiate a kind of questioning of God, because they are helpful, these fathers, in putting me in a situation where I'm not going to understand what St. Isaac of Syria is saying unless I am humbled before God and am willing to accept his help for me to understand. It's not just my intellectual understanding of St. Isaac of Syria. So that's part of how, that's one way that I would say I ask God what to think about something by participating in the way of thinking of the saints, because they have a way of thinking about things, and it's usually different from the way I usually think about things. And we're not talking about formal doctrines of the church here. We're talking about spiritual life. So that's how I do it generally. As far as asking God directly, the only time it really happens with me is in silent prayer, being attentive. That would be probably it. Now, how often do I do that when I have a problem? I have. Generally, the answers come in the form of some prayer that convicts me and shows me this is how you need to pray if you want to deal with whatever this question is, you know, which is how I found the prayer for enemies when I needed it. I needed to know. I needed that because I had something I could not deal with. I was angry, and I didn't know how to deal with it. And that's the only way I would have ever found it. I would have been stuck if I hadn't done that.
I can see how the prayer she gives us at the end of this chapter would be very helpful in that, you know, asking God how to think about things, because it's putting the forefront in your mind, like, you know, take away that feeling that I have, best, so it's not me trying to come up with how to think about that, you know, it, and give me self-knowledge, help me to realize that, you know, I need to be open to, you know, what God's trying to convey to us, whether it's through the saints, you know, and realizing my understanding of the saints is probably not what I need right now, the saints and what they're actually communicating, you know, I mean, to have that humility, see how that prayer would be helpful in putting in that mindset. But you can't be humble enough to gather what they're trying to say.
And the thing about this prayer is we're not asking Jesus Christ for some kind of a way of explaining things to ourselves. Nothing like the kind of thinking that we do when we're looking for a way to justify something. We're not asking for a set of ideas or something like that. Help me to understand this. This prayer isn't asking for that. It's acknowledging that we are self-important. We recognize that as the problem. It's recognizing that we think that we know best, and we're asking him to deliver us from those things. So it's not about answering a question. It's about asking him for something that he wants to give and desiring it. Give me self-knowledge. And that self-knowledge is going to be insight into ourselves. It's not going to be some kind of intellectual insight into the answer of a question, something like that. So yeah, that's probably the best example of. Number four, how does self-importance contribute to willfulness and lead to disobeying the rules and instructions from others? I've zeroed in on page 165, and I'll read from there. Okay, we're talking now about someone who is in a condition where carnal appetites for material things have been fed into our will by pride and vainglory and the passion of self-love. And we're in that kind of spiritual condition. This self-importance dictates that our every desire must be granted. No alternative is accepted. And so how do we react when others give us spiritual advice, spiritual rules, laws even, and commandments that we should follow? They won't be allowed to interfere. They're off the table because we need to gratify these desires. Self-important people don't feel that they have to obey such things. So that you never, if you're in this kind of self-important condition, you never really become fully aware of the fact that there is any conflict because it's off the table. Well, that doesn't apply to me because, well, why is the real reason? Because I'm in this condition. It's got to be this way. Nobody disobeys a command, writes St. Basil the Great, and he's thinking about making the effort to provide spiritual guidance. Nobody disobeys a command without first having condemned the giver of the command. How? By feeling more important than that giver. So how does self-importance contribute to willfulness, lead to disobeying the rules and instructions from others? There it is. But then she cautions us right away that we never want to observe any fault in another person and just leave our thinking there. We all have self-importance. We all have self-importance. We are all in this condition. So when we want advice, we need advice, and we go to people, how likely is it that we are going to take exactly the advice that we need when we're in a dilemma? If our situation is that we are bound up in, by pride, vainglory, and passion of self-love, feeding non-negotiable demands on our part into us. Are we going to listen to anybody, even the best possible advice? And the irony is that we will consider ourselves more important than the person who is giving the best possible advice, no matter who it is. That's how self-importance contributes to willfulness and puts us in a condition where the guidance of others is basically rejected out of hand. Any experience of that kind, or you know, anything anybody wants to comment on that? I've ignored good spiritual advice from some pretty high caliber people in my lifetime. As a seminarian, Father Thomas Hopko, he was tough to have for a Father Confessor, I can tell you. He was tough for me. Why? Willfulness. And of course, he has this high-charged personality, too. I mean, he does full punches. So I wasn't getting anything out of it. Imagine, I mean, we know people who are in our church because of Father Tom, listening to him, listening to his tapes and recordings. He was my Father Confessor. Well, good that he did. I was too self-important and too willful to take advantage of one of the best-known people in our church as far as spiritual guidance. That's sad. I mean, what an opportunity missed there. Question number 5, can you see how getting rid of thinking we know best and self-importance could make it easier to overcome lustful appetites and physical addictions? I can see it if it included that love of the physical self. Because I have a problem with food, which I've mentioned many times. I mean, I know I don't know best when I go to eat the last 2 or 3 pieces of chicken. Because after all, tomorrow is a Wednesday. I won't be able to eat them then. They're going to be all dried up Thursday. So they're good now. There are some really good things she says about here in this chapter about the relationship of lustful appetites to this condition.
165.
Go ahead. 165.
I was just thinking right below where we just were. She says, when we keep praying for it, our illusion of self-importance begins to go down, then our lustful appetites don't feel so important either. You know, satisfying them doesn't feel like such an urgent need. You know, becoming close to being able to resist them. Because we're working more towards humility, so it's just that shift of like, I'm important. What I feel and what I think and what I want is important. And so once you start getting to realize that what you think is best is not what is best, then what you want is not going to be as pressing because you're realizing, well, it's not an urgent need because it's not about me. It's not
right.
About what I think.
Right. There's a point in the chapter where she says something about how we can have lustful appetites, but the thoughts behind them are what gives them most of their strength. This is the top of 166. This is a standard patristic teaching that our carnal desires themselves are pressing but comparatively neutral. That any overwhelming power they have comes from the thoughts in our mind. So if the thoughts in our minds are all justifications, it's not going to be any good Thursday, tomorrow is Wednesday, eat the chicken now, it's the thoughts, not the carnal desire itself. What gives passionate desires their energy and makes them so hard to overcome is pride. Why shouldn't I have that chicken? Filling our mind with ignorant, self-aggrandizing thoughts like, why shouldn't I have that chicken? An explosion of bodily appetites is seen as a classic symptom of unrecognized pride. Right between the eyes. Any final thoughts, comments? Okay, next Wednesday, chapter 10, Esau's depression. Depression. Depression's a big deal these days. Everybody's got it sometimes. Okay, thank you.